You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. Humanity is like an enormous web, so that if you touch it anywhere, you set the whole thing trembling. As we move around this world, and as we act with kindness, perhaps, or with indifference, or with hostility toward the people we meet, we too are setting the great web a tremble. The life that I touch, for good or ill, will touch another life, and that in turn another, until who knows where the trembling stops, or in what far place and time my touch will be felt. Our lives are linked together. No one is an island. Well, good morning and welcome to our service of worship. It is a service because it's built to serve you. And it's worship because it serves you by raising to worth things that matter. My name is Rob McPherson, the minister of this church, and I welcome you here on behalf of generations of Unitarians who have worshipped in similar gatherings in South Australia since 1854. We are a spiritual community that encourages all who come to follow their own spiritual path, to find it, to fashion it, and most importantly, to follow it. Any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. You're invited to kick on with us after the service for tea, coffee, and conversation. Join with me now, please, together in singing our first hymn, Spirit of Life. Please stand as you're able, and we'll sing this twice.
Spirit of life, come unto me.
It's our tradition to share recent events on our spiritual journeys in this open forum of fellowship. This is an act of trust that helps us bind our fellowship more closely together and makes this space sacred. So, if you have had a recent event that's been significant on your spiritual journey, you can share it by coming up, lighting a votive candle, and telling us as briefly as possible about it. Now, as some things may lie too deep for words, you are also welcome to light a candle in silence. Whether you choose to share or not, you can take part in expanding this prayerful circle of compassion by listening with an open heart and mind and by refraining from comment. So now I open our worship space for this sacred act that draws us together in our shared humanity. That's a true story I'm about to tell you. On Thanksgiving Sunday 2013, members of a Mormon congregation in Salt Lake City encountered a homeless man at church that Sunday. There were various reactions to his appearing at church. Some gave him money. 5 people asked him to leave the church property, but most were utterly indifferent, going out of their way to ignore him, not even making eye contact. And he approached people, even those he approached to say, "Happy Thanksgiving," gave no response. He didn't ask for any food or money, yet still most of them blanked him, unable even to acknowledge his presence. Is it better to be loathed or ignored, I wonder? At the beginning of the worship service, he walked up and sat in the front row. When the sermon ended, he leaned forward and asked the pastor in a whisper if he could say a few words. Guess what? What nobody knew was that he was the Mormon bishop. To make his appearance more convincing, he contacted a Salt Lake City makeup artist to transform his familiar face to that of a stranger, so not even his family recognized him. Bishop Musselman, for that was his name, told only the pastor about the ploy. He said he disguised himself that day to teach compassion. He said, quote, "The main thing I was trying to get across was we needn't be so quick to judge." Embarrassed emojis all around. Well, that's Mormons for you, isn't it? Just another sect of hypocritical American Christians, right? No. If you catch yourself thinking in that direction, judging American Mormons as a group for their American Mormonness, you will be missing the point of today's talk on our month of observance about as far as it's possible to miss it without starting to come back again. Do you honestly think that blanking a down-and-out stranger couldn't happen here? Let me tell you, it has happened here to my certain witness, and more than once. Less frequently so, since Warrenilla closed across the street, but when it was open, the occasional person drying out from drink or drugs would turn up on the bench outside having a smoke, you know, which is a sure sign of the leprosy of the 21st century, their hands shaking slightly. They might ask for a cup of tea or coffee, always with lots of sugar. And they may stay for the service to get warm or cool as the weather dictates. And they got blanked, shunned, and eventually encouraged by some otherwise kindly pillar of the community to maybe think about moving along to somewhere else. Which is fair enough. I mean, we are not a halfway house, after all. But a wealthy suburb like Norwood, made wealthier now that developers have scooped up the old Warrenilla property, and the wretched refuse of Osmond Terrace has been shooed away to a less blue-ribbon suburb. A wealthy suburb like this, I say, can have a curious effect on the churches that sit in them, can bring into sharp relief the gap between our best impulses and our actual behavior, between the thoughts and actions we are capable of and the thoughts and actions we let ourselves get by with. The very pleasantness of leafy suburban environments can teach churches to dehumanize certain humans. And yet, at the late Don Simpson's recent funeral, as at his sister Audrey Abbey's before, two pillars of this community, this reading was requested by both of them to remind us of the gap between our most humane values and the actions we let ourselves get by with.
The reading is from Matthew 25. "For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me." Then the righteous will answer him, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you something to drink? When did we see you a stranger and invite you in, or needing clothes and clothe you? When did we see you sick or in prison and go to visit you?" The king will reply, "Truly, I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me."
I want you to think about today, as we develop our theme of the month, about the outgroups we're encouraged by our cultural environment to judge, to harden our hearts to shut our eyes to stop our ears to hold our noses to, like the homeless, the long-term unemployed, the addicted, the mentally ill, the displaced refugee. Why do cultures as large as nations or as small as churches dehumanize certain outgroups? Just as you can see a person's insecurities reflected in whom they judge most readily, you can see a society's insecurities in the outgroups they most readily encourage us to scapegoat and kick down on. Why would a country of colonizing immigrants, like, I don't know, Australia, kick down on people fleeing conflict and squalor? Why would a country that perfected consumer capitalism, like, I don't know, the USA, kick down so hard on its poor? Why would the husk of a decaying empire, like, I don't know, Great Britain, kick down on immigrants from the very colonies that were the jewels of wealth in the crown of its own state, the chickens of its empire coming home to roost? Why, indeed? Cultures reinforce and maintain and reveal their insecurities by encouraging us to dehumanize certain outgroups. Scapegoat thinking can usually be traced to poor metacognition. That is, if we thought about our thinking instead of just reacting, as we are culturally programmed to, we'd see a common flaw in thinking called bad apple thinking, that the worst thing about an outgroup must be the truest. 1.7 billion Muslims globally, but if a few enact murderous rage, it's time to bomb them all. If a few persons on Centrelink overclaim benefits, the poor are all trying to rort the system and need to be managed. If a few crack addicts tear up an ER, all addicts need punishment, not treatment. When you think objectively about that sort of thinking, it really is pretty stupid and lazy. It simplifies complex groups into one thing, usually the worst thing. And this always reveals more about the judge than about the judged. And as it is in groups, so it is with people. The worst thing we know about them is the truest, the most defining. This person had an extramarital affair, so they're a libertine. That person can't find a job, so they're an unemployable loser. But people are complicated. If you take everyone as their worst trait, which of us shall escape whipping? What would it take for us to flip reflexive, unthinking judgment into more mindful compassion? What would it take for us to take people as they indeed are, multi-layered, complex, with good and bad in them, and honor the better of them rather than condemn the worse? Where is that higher love we are called to live by, but already inside us, simply a choice we can make? Would you join me in singing our second hymn, "There Is More Love Somewhere"? Stand as you're able. As you know, or may not know, we are currently engaged in our annual month of observance, and this year's communal spiritual practice is to be mindful about how and who we judge hastily, negatively, and to carve new neural pathways into our plastic wiring so that acceptance becomes more of a habit. months of observing spiritual practices encourage us to live our religion between Sundays and are actually based in actual science of mind. Metacognition, the ability to think about our thinking, and neuroplasticity, that our brains can forge new habits through awareness and repetition of new behavior. If you want the full rationale for months of observance and for why this one, I urge you to listen to our podcasts, previous services, or see the TV broadcast on Channel 44 when it comes out. I'll let you know when that's going to air. And you can share your reflections on our social media sites under the handy hashtag #JudgeNot. That's Facebook and Twitter, because the wristbands were too small for try to entertain more compassionate narratives about others. So judge not. There we go. Things you won't hear or see in those media, either the podcast or the TV show, are the reflection, discussion, and sharing we've done together in church in week one and week two. So if you're new to this, we first buzzed in week one about what we might resent being hastily judged on. I shared with you a couple of things, you know, about being a smoker and so on. And also who we are apt to hastily judge, you know, bad drivers, whatever. The second week, we concentrated on this question when we had about a week to practice it. What did you notice about the judgments you make day to day? What successes did you have? What struggles did you have? What insights? So if you're new to this right now, this service, don't worry. You can concentrate on this first set of questions, the internal ones. Or if you've been here, you can concentrate on the second ones. For those of you who feel bold enough, I'll add a bonus question based on today's subject. What outgroups are you most inclined to judge? Then we might ask a few of you to encourage us all in our work by sharing. Now, take a wristband. This wristband is your daily nag for me. These little reminders, day-to-day practice, are good. These are silicone. You can shower with them, bathe with them, swim with them. You can scale the Eiger with them. And remember, during this month of spiritual practice, there's no coercion in this, and certainly no need to humor me or fake it. So we proceed in the faith and the hope that you'll see the benefits of calling our judgmentalism to mind and taking it apart. So take a few minutes and have a buzz with your neighbors about any one of these questions you care to focus on. Off you go. The object of this is not to get everybody to say, because we have coffee time, which is also part of service, but to just get you thinking in your own life about how these things play out, what you're judging, whether it's actions or whether you've condemned people as a class. It's useful practice. This mindful practice can help us push back against the tide of cultural bias toward dehumanizing groups so that we live more fully this first principle. It doesn't mean we can't judge actions. Of course we can. It does mean we're supposed to value people in themselves, even those we have a culturally conditioned reflex not to value. Recent studies have found that once a person has dehumanized an outgroup, they're less likely to consider their thoughts and feelings. For example, that tendency to dehumanize the homeless people, culturally enforced. In one study, participants were asked to describe a day in the life of a variety of occupations. A student, firefighter, a teacher, a homeless person. Respondents were much less likely to mention the homeless person's emotional state. Think about that a second. We don't actually need to walk in another person's shoes. All we have to do is imagine walking in them. And people in the study were perfectly capable of imaginatively walking in the shoes of a student or a firefighter or a teacher, things they may have no direct experience of. And yet most in the study seemed incapable even to imagine the inner life of the homeless. Why would that be? Where do such differences in our ability even to imagine a narrative come from, if not from what the culture allows? We fail to imagine what the culture is trying to ignore, deny, or forget about. These studies show dehumanization can even affect our brain's activity. When subjects look at people they dehumanize, there's actually less activity in the medial prefrontal cortex, the area of the brain responsible for social awareness. So the takeaway is dehumanizing makes us measurably less capable of abstract thought. It makes us less than fully human. So dehumanizing makes us less than human. That's ironic, isn't it? In this context, I wonder if you can appreciate how very radical and fundamental our first principle is. We affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. Think about that a second. Inherent worth and dignity. Inherent means, of course, given, built into our nature. But is that actually true? Aren't humans just a meaningless accident? An anxious bag of random atoms differing only from other space dust by our ability to delude ourselves into thinking we may be something more than material reductionism allows. Why should we deny our own consciousness? That we are as aware of ourselves as no other living creature is aware of itself, and that the rest of the lifeless universe cannot be. Of course, self, a self, can mean nothing to anyone determined to deny it. But why would you? Even if self is an illusion created by the material brain, there's no reason to question the fact that a self exists, any more than to question that our lived experience exists, like balance or visual perception. If the human self and our experience is not real, it doesn't much matter what we do to each other or to the world. We live as though it does matter and matters deeply. And why would we deny that all others are conscious and unique selves, just as we experience ourselves to be? Either every human being has an inherent value and a unique character, or they do not, or only some do, and some don't. And God help us, who gets to decide that? This is the really ambitious part of our first principle. Every person has worth and dignity. Every one. Historically, this is the universalism in Unitarian Universalism, that no one is beyond redemption. Even the people we fear, even the people that hurt us, even those we just don't like. What would it be like? What sort of world would we have if we really took this principle as our conscious daily spiritual practice? The thing is, it is hard to do so, and it is easy to encourage people to dehumanize others. All human social groups, as large as nations or as small as churches, seem to need some sort of outgroup to scapegoat through some alleged deficiency in their inherent nature. Rendering the least of these less than the rest of us, and therefore less than fully as human as us. And once you put one foot on that slippery slope, well, throwing refugees off support payments, putting them in squalid camps, tearing apart undocumented families is a natural extension and a logical extension of that slope. In the lifetime of people sitting in this room, dehumanizing judgment has led directly to some of the most horrific crimes against humanity. Must I name them? Which is why, finally, it matters that we, you and I, take opportunities to affirm and promote our first principle, because practice it in the public sphere, not just nod at it in bovine assent until the next handy scapegoat comes along. Because dehumanizing language, friends, is out there in our culture as it hasn't been in generations, and dehumanizing language can really determine how we treat people. Study after study confirms this. In one, researchers, you'll love this, subtly exposed participants to metaphors comparing women to animals. The participants subsequently showed a spike in hostile sexism. Dehumanizing language has also been linked to an increased willingness to act out violent thoughts. Again, research shows that those who, say, dehumanize Arabs are more supportive of things like torture, the targeting of civilians, and even bombing whole countries. At its most extreme, dehumanizing messages and propaganda can facilitate our support for war and genocide. We have seen this happen within the living memory of every single person in this room. No matter how young you are, we saw it when the Tutsi people were referred to as cockroaches and what that led to. We heard the language when Balkan nations started referring to each other as vermin and what that led to. In fact, international NGOs cite dehumanizing speech as one of the precursors to genocide. It can relax our instinctive aversion to aggression and violence. So it is critical now, as never before, that we Unitarians need to affirm and promote our alternative values and express and live them. I started with the true story. Here's another. This week would have been Anne Frank's 89th birthday. No one who has read her diary could fail to see the shining human worth captured forever in the amber of her words. But the lesson for us is that it was students, firefighters, teachers, suburbanites, workers, ordinary folk like us who rounded up 6 million like Anne Frank precisely to exterminate them. The Holocaust did not start with camps and gas chambers, but with dehumanization in thought and speech, with day-to-day choices of thought and words that ordinary people like you and me become inured to, that ordinary people like you and me become used to using, that ordinary people like you and me could thus more easily enact. What we think, we become. Yes, even us. Hence months of observance like this one that draws to a close next week. So let us watch our thoughts, for the thoughts we allow ourselves today will surely create our world tomorrow. Amen. The thought manifests as the word manifests as the deed develops into habit, and the habit hardens into character. So watch the thought and its way with care, and let it spring from love, born out of concern for all beings. Amen, and have a great week.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.